Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today's Greatest Briton is Florence Nightingale. And of course, your hosts for the episode will be myself, Sven Longshanks, and Max Musson from Western Spring. Shall we get into our Greatest Britons for this week then, Max? A female Greatest Briton? Yeah, we've got a female Greatest Briton this week. Somebody, one of the greatest of great Britons, I think, as well. She's influenced the entire world. And I really didn't know that much about her until compiling the notes for this. But it really shouldn't be underestimated what she did. She completely changed the idea of nursing and turned it into a trade and a career and an honourable thing to do. And before she did that, it really wasn't it wasn't anything. It was just seen as a chore that people had to do. They had to look after people when they were ill or look after people when they were dying. Nobody was actually looking at how they could improve on the way people were, to improve their recovery time and looking at the hygiene of the people. None of this was actually done until the time of Florence Nightingale, who we will be talking about today. She was born on the 12th of May, 1820, and died on the 13th of August, 1910. She was an English social reformer, a statistician, and the founder of modern nursing. And as I say, we really can't underestimate that. She really started the whole idea of nursing. She came to prominence while serving as a manager and trainer of nurses during the Crimean War, in which she organized the care for wounded soldiers. She gave nursing a favourable reputation and became an icon of Victorian culture, especially in her persona of the lady with the lamp, making the rounds of wounded soldiers at night. And she really must have seemed like an angel to these soldiers that were there, that were, maimed and their bodies falling apart. And there's this lovely lady that's coming round that's checking on them, making sure they're okay, making sure that they're fed okay. You know, you really can't underestimate what she did. Do you want to comment on this brief introduction here, Max?
Well, just to say that everything you've said so far, I firmly believe to be true. I think that she, as we'll demonstrate when we go on to talk more about her, she is somebody who really ought to be an icon of the feminist movement, in fact, because she's somebody who was out of the ordinary for her time, and she was a young lady who was born into quite a wealthy family, and young ladies born into wealthy families during the 19th century were expected to become wives and to marry men and to have children, but she chose to have a career. She was encouraged to study science by her father, and she's somebody who became, as you say, an icon through her the application of her common sense in upgrading nursing from being something that people kind of reluctantly did because they didn't have anything better to do, and upgrading it into a professional career that women can and men can enter into and can sort of look upon with pride.
Well, it does show you that this nonsense that the feminists tell us that women were oppressed and they really couldn't do anything, that's just not true. If women wanted to do something different other than get married and have children, they could do that, particularly if they were wealthy enough to do that. But most women didn't want to do that, and Florence Nightingale was the exception to the rule. And she does prove that the rule is there. The primary function of women is nurturing and to produce children, and it all depends on their nurturing, what that child grows into, and that is the primary role. But there are always exceptions to the rule, and Florence Nightingale was a particularly good exception to the rule. In 1860, she laid the foundation of professional nursing with the establishment of a nursing school at St Thomas's Hospital in London. It was the first secular nursing school in the world and is now a part of King's College, London. So I guess it was always done by nuns and done by churches before then. In recognition of her pioneering work in nursing, the Nightingale Pledge is taken by new nurses, and the Florence Nightingale Medal is the highest international distinction a nurse can achieve. Both were named in her honour, and the annual International Nurses Day is celebrated on her birthday. She was also a prodigious and versatile writer. In her lifetime, much of her published work was concerned with spreading medical knowledge, and many of her tracts were written in simple English so that they could easily be understood by those with poor literary skills. She was also a pioneer in data visualization with the use of infographics, effectively using graphical presentations for statistical data. So she made this information available to the general public. It wasn't just academic textbooks that only doctors could really understand. She made this information available for everyone. She actually increased the life expectancy by about 20 years, pretty much, with what she actually did. It wasn't just in nursing that she was involved in. She was also involved in hygiene in the homes and sanitation and sewage. She had a massive effect in India, massive effect in Britain, in Switzerland, even in America. She was training people that went out to America and brought these ideas over there to America as well. A really wonderful woman. And do you want to comment on that, Max, about the statistics or the infographics that she used as well, that she's known for?
That's right. I think she was a very accomplished mathematician, and this enabled her to do all sorts of statistical analysis in order to prove her theories correct. And she had the sort of infographics was the way in which she presented the statistical material in a graphic form to make it more readily understandable by other people. And it's reminiscent, really, the work that she did. Her life is reminiscent of the career of Francis Galton that we've spoken about before, where, you know, he was celebrated as a polymath, somebody who'd got a very high level of intellectual ability in a wide number of fields. And it also appears that was the case also with Florence Nightingale. Not only was she able to use the experiences that she had in order to benefit just purely nursing, but also the construction of hospitals and the design of sanitation, etc., for people's homes and for other sort of institutions like prisons. And it was her understanding of statistics and her ability to prove her theories through statistics, which is reminiscent, as I say, of Francis Galton, that made her such a prodigious person.
I think she pioneered the use of the pie chart. I think it was invented by somebody else, but it really took off when she started using that. She would use that to illustrate a lot of the information she was trying to get across. Well, let's have a look then in more detail at her life here. Florence Nightingale was born on 12th of May 1820 into a wealthy and well-connected British family at the Villa Columbia in Florence, Tuscany, Italy, and was named after the city of her birth. Florence and her older sister Parthenope studied history, mathematics, Italian, classical literature and philosophy, and from an early age, Florence, who was the more academic of the two girls, displayed an extraordinary ability for collecting and analysing data, which she would use to great effect in later life. She exhibited a gift for mathematics from an early age and excelled in the subject under the tutelage of her father, and later in life became a pioneer in the visual presentation of information and statistical graphs using methods such as the pie chart, which had first been developed by William Playfair in 1801. While taken for granted now, it was at that time a relatively novel method for presenting data. And this is really surprising that she was very good at mathematics, because that's not really something that you find many women that are actually involved in that. It's very unlikely that women are going to be good at mathematics. It's a very masculine thing, and yet she really excelled at that. And when you look at the different disciplines that she was studying, I mean, that's quite incredible. History, mathematics, Italian, classical literature and philosophy, and this was from an early age. And this is what you could do if you had a wealthy family. Then you could afford to be well educated. Obviously her father could afford to get tutors in for them. This was before the age of general education for everyone. So he obviously invested well in his daughters. I should imagine he was a bit disappointed that she didn't marry. She did remain celibate throughout her life, as have some of the men that we've talked about during this time, during the time of the British Empire. So it was a shame that she didn't actually produce children, but she did make up for that with all that she did. And you pointed out there as well, Max, that it's a shame that the feminists don't make more of her. She was quite scathing of the feminist types. She didn't see them as being any help at all. She understood that she was the exception to the rule, and what she was doing was different to what most women would have wanted to do, but she certainly wanted to make her mark. Do you want to comment on her early life here, Max?
No, I think we've said all that needs to be said, really, about the attitude of her father encouraging her and her sister in studies, and the fact that she was remarkably proficient in a wide range of different subjects, thereby suggesting that she was perhaps a polymath in the same sense that Francis Galton was, and the use of the use of statistics, as we've already covered, and making statistics not just using statistics, but making those statistics more readily understandable by other people, so that the knowledge that she gained could have wider application, and other people could use her ideas more easily.
Yeah, it's not just knowing this stuff, is it? It's being able to communicate it to others so that it can be shared. Because you're going to have the brightest people, the most intelligent people, but they may not be able to communicate that well. But, you know, we have a lot of geniuses that are very autistic, they're very socially dysfunctional, and they're not really able to make that information available to the wider population. And she wasn't like that. She was able to get this information out there. Well, the most famous part of her life was during the Crimean War, and this is what she's most famous for. Florence Nightingale's most famous contribution came during the Crimean War, which became her central focus when reports came back to Britain about the horrific conditions for the wounded. On the 21st of October 1854, she and a staff of 38 women volunteer nurses that she had trained, including her aunt May Smith and 15 Catholic nuns, were sent to the Ottoman Empire. They were deployed about 295 nautical miles across the Black Sea from Baklava in the Crimea, where the main British camp was based. Arriving early in November 1854 at Selimi Barracks in Skutari, which is modern-day Üsküdar in Istanbul, her team found that poor care for wounded soldiers was being delivered by an overworked medical staff in the face of official indifference. Medicines were in short supply, hygiene was being neglected, and mass infections were common, with many of them proving fatal. There was not even any equipment to process food for the patients. And this reminds me a bit of what Gordon was up against, problems with official indifference. And she was trying to look after our own people. She was trying to look after the British here. I mean, Gordon was concerned with the Sudanese and the Chinese, but even with the British people and the British soldiers, they weren't being looked after. And the fault was with the establishment, once again. After she sent a plea to the Times for a government solution to the poor condition of the facilities, the British government commissioned Isambard Kingdom Brunel to design a prefabricated hospital that could be built in England and then shipped to the Dardanelles. The result was the Renkoi Hospital, a civilian facility that, under the management of Dr. Edmund Alexander Parks, had a death rate less than one-tenth of that of the Scutari. So 90% of the deaths were avoidable, and it's thanks to her that they were actually avoided. And it was also down to this hospital that Isambard Kingdom Brunel designed, and I'm hoping we'll get a chance to talk about him as one of our greatest Britons. Do you want to comment on any of this, Max, and her start here in the Crimean War?
Well, just that field hospitals in those days used to be quite sort of primitive affairs initially, and it's interesting that typhus, typhoid, dysentery, and cholera were widespread amongst the troops. What would happen is that the troops would be injured, and lots of them would be brought into a centre where they would then be treated. But because of the wounds that they had, infections would set in, and those infections would, because of the lack of knowledge of aseptic technique and things of that sort, those infections would spread very rapidly, and the field hospitals would take on the kind of the sort of appearance of a concentration camp with lots of very emaciated soldiers who became emaciated because they couldn't hold food down because of the typhoid and typhus that they were, and the dysentery that they were suffering from, and the death rates were very, very high. And it's interesting that during the period of Florence Nightingale carrying out this kind of remedial work in field hospitals in the sort of Ukraine, where this was taking place, Crimea, that those field hospitals were very similar to the concentration camps that came to be a feature of the American Civil War, and that came to be a feature of the war against the war in South Africa against the Boers, and subsequently in the 20th century, the concentration camps that existed across Europe during the Second World War. All of the places where large numbers of people are congregated together, where there are insanitary conditions, they all develop into places where very large numbers of people die quite unnecessarily. And it's the work that had been done by Florence Nightingale that meant that, certainly as far as field hospitals are concerned, that situation was turned around, and the field hospitals became places where soldiers were taken to recover rather than places where they were taken to die.
I'd like to see the prefab that was designed by Isambard Kingdom Brunel. I bet that looked pretty good as well. During her first winter at Scutari, 4,077 soldiers died there, with 10 times more actually dying from the illnesses, like you just mentioned there, Max, typhus, typhoid, cholera and dysentery, than actually dying from the battle wounds. With overcrowding, defective sewers and a lack of ventilation. Think of that, defective sewers. You've got human waste that's just flowing around the beds. It must have been absolutely disgusting. Because of that, the Sanitary Commission had to be sent out by the British government to Scutari in March 1855, almost 6 months after Nightingale had arrived. So it's thanks to her that she got this Sanitary Commission sent out there. And the commission flushed out the sewers and improved the ventilation. Death rates were sharply reduced by this, but she never actually claimed credit for it and was sure that more could be done due to the poor nutrition, the lack of supplies, the stale air and the overworking of the soldiers. So as you say there, Max, it was changing the place from somewhere that people were put and just left in the hopes that they wouldn't die to being somewhere that people would hopefully be able to recuperate, that had ventilation, that had proper sanitation, where the food was looked at, the supplies were looked at. And stale air was very important as well, you know, getting the ventilation in there, getting the air through there. And this is one of the reasons why people get sick today, is because of all the double glazing. You know, I can remember when I was a kid, you know, I was told, well, you've got to have the windows open. You've got to let the fresh air in. You've got to let these germs get in so that you can fight against them. And now, since we've had all this double glazing, we have a lot of kids with allergies. And I think a lot of that is because they're not exposed to the fresh air enough. Next up, we have an incident where she met Mary Seacole, which is quite famous. And I believe you know quite a bit about Mary Seacole, Max. We'll get into that in a minute. According to some secondary sources, Nightingale had a frosty relationship with her, quote, fellow nurse, Mary Seacole, who ran a hotel hospital for officers. Seacole's own memoir, Wonderful Adventures of Mrs. Seacole in Many Lands, records only one friendly meeting with her, when she asked her for a bed for the night and got it. Seacole was in Scutari en route to the Crimea to join her business partner and start their business. However, Seacole pointed out that when she tried to join Nightingale's group, one of Nightingale's colleagues rebuffed her, and Seacole inferred that racism was at the root of that rebuttal. And racism hadn't even been invented by that time. Trotsky hadn't even come up with the term, so I doubt whether she actually used that term. And it refers to this Mary Seacole as a fellow nurse, but of course we've been told that nursing didn't really start until Nightingale started it, so she can't have been a nurse in the same, so up to the same standard as Florence was. So that
I think up to the time of Florence Nightingale, people very often became nurses because they were quite often for religious purposes because they were nuns, but also where women were widowed and they had no other means of support, and they had no other trade or skill, then they very often would become nurses. Or if they were any women, it tended to be, who found themselves with no means of financial support, would often become nurses, and because they had no training, they very often weren't as good as they might have otherwise been. And I think, as far as Mary Seacole is concerned, she was a young woman who inherited a hotel, I think it was, in the Caribbean from an aunt or a grandmother. And she was taught by her mother a number of folk remedies that had come from Africa, because her parents were her ancestry was African through slave routes, and so Mary Seacole was a woman who was typical of the time, somebody who had come into doing work which is comparable to nursing, but who had actually had no proper nursing training whatsoever. And up until her ventures to the Crimea, Mary Seacole had run a hotel in the Caribbean, which was for retired, which was frequented primarily by retired military men who had gone there to enjoy the tropical climate, because it's beneficial for their wounds or for any medical conditions or whatever that they actually had. And so she had a certain amount of experience of dealing with sick people, but she had never had any formal nursing training whatsoever. And so I think that when she was rebuffed by Florence Nightingale, she was probably rebuffed because she hadn't undertaken any training and probably wasn't prepared to undertake training before she was let loose on actual patients, and probably wanted to just be accepted as if she was a nurse, because she had been doing work that was in some way comparable to nursing in the past.
Now, I think she was out there on a business venture as well. Florence Nightingale was out there volunteering to do this. The response to this, actually, Florence Nightingale actually told her brother-in-law in a private letter that she had been worried about contact between her work and Seacole's business, claiming that while she was very kind to the men, and what is more, to the officers, and did do some good, she also made many of them drunk. I had the greatest difficulty in repelling Mrs. Seacole's advances and in preventing association between her and my nurses, which was absolutely out of the question. Anyone who employs Mrs. Seacole will introduce much kindness, but also much drunkenness and improper conduct. And I would question about this this hotel that she actually had out in the Caribbean, whether it might have partially operated as a brothel. But she certainly wasn't up to the standard of Florence Nightingale, as a nurse. I believe you mentioned something about the fact that they've got a statue or a memorial of Seacole, and actually dwarfs Florence Nightingale's statue somewhere, Max. Is that right?
This is in the wake of the Black Lives Matter issue earlier on this year. What's happened is a campaign grew up amongst the wokearty for Mary Seacole to be celebrated on a par with Florence Nightingale, on the basis that she had an establishment in the Crimea. Mary Seacole's establishment in the Crimea, there wasn't a proper hospital. It was a cross between a hotel, a restaurant, and a general store. And so she sold provisions to the soldiers. She sold them homespun folk remedies for the ailments that they had and the injuries that they had. And she provided a place of lodging for officers who wanted somewhere to rest from the rigors of warfare, and to recover from wounds that they had, and also a place where they could go and eat in kind of restaurant kind of facilities. And so it was a business that she was running. Apparently she did give some of her medical remedies and things to some of the poor soldiers for free. And so, you know, she wasn't a completely She wasn't a bad woman in that respect, but she wasn't a nurse. She was somebody who was running an altogether different kind of establishment to a professional hospital. She was running an informal kind of rest home, come restaurant, come hotel, basically. And so it was an entirely different thing. But what's happened is that as a result of this campaign that was whipped up by the Wokearty in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests earlier on this year, a statue of Mary Seacole has been created, which is larger than the statue of Florence Nightingale that is at St Thomas's Hospital, and so therefore not only is Mary Seacole set to be celebrated on a par with Florence Nightingale, even though her accomplishments with regard to nursing etc are dwarfed by the accomplishments of Florence Nightingale, but Mary Seacole's statue is actually larger and put in a more prominent place than that of Florence Nightingale's, which I think is rather insulting to the memory of Florence Nightingale, especially when we consider that Florence Nightingale wasn't just a nurse. Florence Nightingale was a woman who developed the nursing profession and established nursing as a profession on a par with any other kind of profession in this country, and who did so much more as well with regard to domestic sanitation, etc., as we've already discussed, and who introduced modern scientific methods of evaluation and statistical analysis in order to develop the ideas that she had, which have since been shown to be of great benefit.
I don't think that there's any comparison, is there, really? I mean, this Mary Seacole, she sounds like a good time girl. I look what Florence Nightingale says here: much drunkenness and improper conduct. And what do you think that improper conduct was with these officers going there? They were obviously paying money to stay there at a hotel and eat. And, you know, how does that compare to somebody who volunteers to set up a hospital to look after these people and feed them and make sure that they have clean water and proper sanitation? I mean, it was a business venture that Seacole was involved in. It's just no comparison there. And it's insulting to the memory of Florence Nightingale to put this statue of Seacole there, and also to infer that there was somehow racism was the reason for why she didn't want to be involved with her. And this shows us that, you know, black people have had a chip on their shoulder against us all the way back then, 180 years ago, or however far back this was, 150 years ago. She's blaming prejudice and saying that she was somehow being discriminated against by Florence Nightingale, when the fact of the matter is that she had no training, she had a bad reputation, and she didn't want her, Nightingale didn't want her nurses to have anything to do with her, or the people that worked with her. She says here, absolutely out of the question. You know, and it's not because she didn't like the colour of her skin, it's because of the drunkenness and the improper conduct that was associated with her. And she says here, I'm sure she was very kind to them, but the problem is she also got them drunk. And how is that going to help you when you are recuperating from wounds? Your drunkenness, I mean, it might give you a brief bit of anaesthesia, but the long-term effects of it are, it's going to be more harmful than good when you're trying to recuperate. So yeah, it's just, you know, it just shows you that this problem that we have, we're trying to mix the races together, it's been going on for forever, basically. And it seems that there's always been this idea that the white man is somehow oppressing the black man, and it's just not true. And we see that here, because she thought she was being oppressed, and in actual fact that wasn't the reason why she didn't want to have anything to do with her. It was just for purely sensible reasons. She didn't want drunkenness and improper conduct. She wanted to run a hospital and improve people's lives, and that would have also given her a bad reputation, wouldn't it? It would have given Florence Nightingale a bad reputation if that sort of thing had been going on there. Yeah, let's get back into Florence Nightingale, who we began talking about last week. Actually, on this day in history, when we were recording this, which is on the Sunday afternoon, Florence Nightingale, aged 87, was presented with the Order of Merit by Edward VII for her work tending the wounded during the Crimean War. So we're actually very topical that we are talking about Florence Nightingale right now. Well, let's start with a recap of what we talked about last week. Florence Nightingale laid the foundation of professional nursing with the establishment of her nursing school at King's College London. She came from a wealthy family whose connections she used to push for improvements in sanitation and healthcare once she was an adult. She was a polymath, and her family could afford to give her a really good education in multiple disciplines. So she really made use of the fact that she had this this above average intelligence, far above average intelligence. And during the Crimean War that she volunteered to help out at, she realized that 10 times as many soldiers were dying from disease rather than from their wounds. And she persuaded Britain to send a commission there to clean the sewers out and create a prefabricated hospital to use. And that massively reduced the death rate. And then at the end of last week, we talked about Mary Seacole, the black hostess or a mulatto hostess. One of her parents was white and the other parent was black. And she famously met with Florence Nightingale in Crimea and wanted to volunteer to help. But Florence turned her help away as she was untrained and she had a reputation for introducing drunkenness and improper conduct among the soldiers. And we talked about last week about this memorial to Mary Seacole, which is absolutely huge. It's 4.5 metres high and it's put right outside King's College London, right outside where Florence Nightingale was. It really is an insult to Florence Nightingale to actually put this huge, great memorial there. And apparently they really try to push this Mary Seacole as if she did, as if she was anywhere near as much of an influence as Florence Nightingale was. And though she may have been a good person, she wasn't really a nurse. She didn't have training. They try to portray it, the fact that she volunteered to help in the Crimea and Florence Nightingale turned her away. She didn't. It was actually a business that she wanted to set up there, the same sort of business that she had in the Caribbean, running a hotel come rest place that sold alcohol and just had ill people there, basically. I mean, it's good of her to look after ill people, but she wasn't volunteering to do this. It was a business that she was going out there to set up in the Crimea. She wasn't fully black. She was half black and half white. And they seem to have really latched on to her today. And they try to portray her role as just as important as Florence Nightingale's. And it's not. And thankfully, all the organizations that support Florence Nightingale do actually point this out. And they did try to prevent this huge, great memorial being placed outside the hospital. But they were unable to do that, unfortunately. It just is a real insult to do that to her and put that outside the hospital there. Do you want to add anything to this recap, Max? Do you remember anything else that you want to add to it?
Well, really, just on that last point, just to concur with what you were saying there, I think that that Mary Seacole would appear to have been a good woman, and she was a good business person. She knew where to site her businesses so that they would be very profitable and well received by the injured soldiers and those that were recuperating just back from the front. But the establishment that she had couldn't possibly be described as a hospital. She had no nursing training. She didn't take any part in the development of nursing training. She didn't develop the logistics of running hospitals or anything of that sort. She didn't pioneer aseptic technique as practiced by nurses today in order to treat people without spreading infection. And so, yes, it's quite right that to have this enormous memorial for her cited where it is it's really just a manifestation of the sort of extreme woke nature of our society at the moment, and the fact that the authorities are scratching around trying to find significant black people from our history that they can promote as if they are as significant as people who are towering figures like Florence Nightingale was. And so it's really silly on their part. I think when people are and students of the future are asked to study Mary Seacole as if she was on a par with Florence Nightingale, then it will become screamingly apparent to the students that are undertaking those studies that that they are indeed two entirely different women who had two entirely different purposes, and Mary Seacole's was to run a kind of rest home and hotel come restaurant business and general store, whereas Florence Nightingale was the pioneer in terms of creating modern nursing.
That's if they tell us the truth. I mean, they may start to credit the things Florence Nightingale did actually to Mary Seacole. The BBC have a programme on at the moment, a new series, and it's all about this great, wonderful black Briton. And you know what he did? He was the first black police officer. And we've had the same with Google. They had the first black fireman, I believe, the other day as their Google Doodle. They're so desperate to find black people in our history. When they find them, they make out they did this most amazing thing. And all they actually did was get a job. He got a job as a policeman. He got a job as a fireman. You know, white people have been getting jobs as policemen and firemen for centuries, and it's nothing special. It just shows their desperation to insert people that are not indigenous to this country into our history, and to pretend that they have always been here. They haven't always been here. They've only been here for the last 70 years. Well, getting back to the Crimean War here, Florence Nightingale is well known as the Lady with the Lamp, and it was at this time that she gained that nickname. The actual phrase is from a report in the Times. Quote, "She is a ministering angel without any exaggeration in these hospitals. And as her slender form glides quietly along each corridor, every poor fellow's face softens with gratitude at the sight of her. When all the medical officers have retired for the night and silence and darkness have settled down upon those miles of prostrate sick, she may be observed alone with a little lamp in her hand, making her solitary rounds." So this shows us that she was a real hands-on nurse. She wasn't just ordering other people around. She was taking part in this, and she really must have seemed like a ministering angel. If you imagine what these soldiers had been through before Florence Nightingale went out there, they were just left to rot in lying there amongst their own waste, basically, with nobody really to take care of them. And then suddenly that changes, and you have these nurses that are going around, everything is clean, you've got fresh air, you've got somebody coming around every night to make sure that everybody is okay. You know, she really must have seemed like an angel to them, and she quite rightly was given all these awards and accolades for her charity, really, because that's what this boils down to. It's her charitable nature in combination with her intelligence and her realization of what was going on there. Well, in the Crimea, on the 29th of November 1855, the Nightingale Fund was established for the training of nurses during a public meeting to recognise Nightingale for her work in the war, and there was an outpouring of generous donations. Sidney Herbert served as Honorary Secretary of the Fund, and the Duke of Cambridge was the chairman. She would later be considered a pioneer in the concept of medical tourism as well, based on her 1856 letters describing the spas in the Ottoman Empire. She detailed the health conditions, physical descriptions, dietary information, and other vital details of all the patients that she directed there, and the treatment they received was considerably less expensive than in Switzerland. So we see here there is a fund being set up, and there's a big outpouring of generous donations. And part of that, I would probably suggest, was her family connections, because she came from this very wealthy family. So she was able to put that to use as well as all these achievements. So they set up this massive fund for the training of nurses. And besides that as well, this concept of medical tourism, I mean, this still goes on today. People go out to Bulgaria to get their teeth seen to, or they can go to Mexico for the same thing. And you know that you're going to get just as good a treatment there as you are in Britain, because it's all the same in the EU. And what she was saying here is people should go out to the Ottoman Empire. They've got the spas there. We don't have them in Britain. And also this treatment here that she was talking about in Switzerland, and this fund for the training of nurses, that was the first time that they actually had proper training of nurses. Up until that point, it had just been something that the daughter of the family that didn't have a husband or whatever, she would have to look after the dying person at home. And this is the first time you actually had training of these people to look after people in hospitals. And this was all her idea. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max?
Well, just really to concur with what you've been saying there, that nursing up until the point that Florence Nightingale intervened was largely an occupation taken up by, as you say, the children of the family who were girls predominantly who became spinsters would then look after the sick older generation as they advanced in years, but also women who became widowed and who had no other form of income and who had no other training would very often become nurses, and so it was largely an untrained occupation and consequently wasn't recognised as a profession at all. And it was the regulation that Florence Nightingale introduced and the training that she introduced that transformed nursing into a proper profession.
Well, after she returned to Britain and began collecting evidence before the Royal Commission on the Health of the Army, she came to believe that most of the soldiers at the hospital had been killed by the poor living conditions. This experience influenced her later career, when she advocated sanitary living conditions as being of great importance. Consequently, she reduced peacetime deaths in the army as well, and turned her attention to the sanitary design of hospitals and the introduction of sanitation in working class homes. In 1860, with £45,000 that she had at her disposal from the Nightingale Fund, she set up the Nightingale Training School at St Thomas's Hospital. The first of her trained Nightingale nurses began work on the 16th of May 1865 at the Liverpool Workhouse Infirmary, now called the Florence Nightingale School of Nursing and Midwifery. The school is a part of King's College London. And what we see here is that she wasn't just helping the people in the army, she was helping the poor. This was set up in the Liverpool Workhouse Infirmary, so she did a lot of work to improve the lives of the people that were in these workhouses, to make sure that they had sanitary conditions there, and also in these working class homes. So it was for, it was the whole population that actually ended up benefiting from what she was doing here. And in 1859, she had authored Notes on Nursing, and the book served as the cornerstone of the curriculum at the Nightingale School and other nursing schools, although it was written specifically for the education of those nursing at home. So this information wasn't just given to the specialists. This book was there for the people that were working at home, as you were describing just there, Max. Nightingale wrote in this book, "Everyday sanitary knowledge, or the knowledge of nursing, or in other words, of how to put the constitution into such a state as that it will have no disease, or that it can recover from disease, takes a higher place. It is recognized as the knowledge which everyone ought to have, as distinct from medical knowledge which only a profession can have." So she made this information available to the public, and the book itself also sold well to the general reading public and is considered a classic introduction to nursing. For the introduction to the 1974 edition, Joan Quixley of the Nightingale School of Nursing wrote, "This book was the first of its kind ever to be written. It appeared at a time when the simple rules of health were only beginning to be known, when its topics were of vital importance, not only for the well-being and recovery of patients, when hospitals were riddled with infection, and when nurses were still mainly regarded as ignorant, uneducated persons. The book has inevitably its place in the history of nursing, for it was written by the founder of modern nursing." And what I find interesting there is the book is still in print, and this is being published in 1974. So over 125 years later, the book that she wrote is still being read by the public, because the information that was in there was pretty much timeless, and still being, our homes are still based upon it today with the sanitary knowledge and that sort of information that we need to have clean water, we need to be able to keep things clean, we need to have fresh air. I think she actually reduced the death rate by about 20%, something like that. We'll get onto that later. But you've got any comments on her book here, The Notes on Nursing or The Nursing School, Max?
Not specifically on the book. It's just that an interesting aspect of all this is that hospitals prior to Florence Nightingale used to be more hospices than hospitals. They were places where people who were ill went to die, to be nursed during their death, basically. And this is illustrated in that the word hospital is derived from the term spittlehouse. And so hospitals used to be called spittlehouses. And so there's the area of London called Spitalfields, which is obviously sort of a field where there would perhaps have been a hospital of some sort. And this was like a reference to people going there and coughing up disease spittle, basically, and having and so that gives us an idea of the sort of state hospitals were in prior to Florence Nightingale intervening.
Oh, I had no idea of that. Spittle. So, yeah, particularly gross. You imagine it. There are quite a few places that are actually named after spittle, aren't they? Well, one of her signature achievements was the introduction of trained nurses into the workhouse system of Britain from the 1860s onwards. This meant that sick paupers were no longer being cared for by other able-bodied paupers, but by properly trained nursing staff. In the first half of the 19th century, nurses were usually former servants or widows who found no other job, and therefore were forced to earn their living by this work. Charles Dickens caricatured this standard of care in his 1842 published novel Martin Chuzzlewit in the figure of Sarah Gamp as being incompetent, negligent, alcoholic, and corrupt. According to Caroline Worthington, the director of the Florence Nightingale Museum, when she, Nightingale, started out, there was no such thing as nursing. The Dickens character, Sarah Gamp, who was more interested in drinking gin than looking after her patients, was only a mild exaggeration. Hospitals were places of last resort where the floors were laid with straw to soak up the blood. Florence transformed nursing when she got back from the Crimea. She had access to people in high places and she used it to get things done. She was stubborn, opinionated and forthright, but she had to be those things in order to achieve all that she did. So we see here that this idea of actually looking after the poor that were in this work, in these workhouses as well. You didn't just work them to death and if they lost their limbs, just leave them. Now they actually looked after them, and they still looked after them in the workhouse themselves. Have you got any comments to make on this, Max?
Well, just that, you know, what you were saying there about Florence Nightingale's character, the fact that she sort of appears to me to be a kind of Margaret Thatcher-esque character, not in terms of her politics, but in terms of her stubbornness and opinionatedness and the way in which she felt that she had to behave in order to get things done in what was a man's world at the time.
Yeah, I think she was quite masculine, actually, in a lot of her attributes. You know, she was the exception to the rule. She wasn't really supportive of the feminists either, as we will hear later on. Well, her work also served as an inspiration for nurses during the American Civil War, with the Union government approaching her for advice in organizing field medicine. Her ideas went on to inspire the volunteer body of the United States Sanitary Commission. In the 1870s, Nightingale mentored Linda Richards, America's first trained nurse, and enabled her to return to the United States with enough training and knowledge to establish her own high-quality nursing schools. Richards went on to become a nursing pioneer in both America and Japan. And I was really surprised there. I thought the American Civil War actually took place a lot further ago than that, in the 1850s. And is that right? The American Civil War was in the 1850s, around about that time, Max? I thought it was...
It was the late 1800s.
Wow. Wow. I always imagined it was a long time further back than that. Well, she didn't just make these improvements in America. She also made improvements in India. Her attention turned to the health of the British Army in India, and she demonstrated that bad drainage, contaminated water, overcrowding and poor ventilation were causing the high death rate, and after making a comprehensive statistical study of sanitation in Indian rural life, she became a leading figure for the introduction of improved medical care and public health service for the country. In 1858, she successfully lobbied for the establishment of a royal commission into the Indian situation, and 2 years later she provided the report to the commission, which completed its own study in 1863. Following her report, which included drawings done by her cousin, artist Hilary Bonham Carter, with whom Nightingale had lived, she concluded that the health of the army and the people of India had to go hand in hand, and campaigned to improve the sanitary conditions of the country as a whole. After 10 years of her sanitary reform in 1873, she was able to report that mortality among the soldiers in India had declined from 69 deaths to just 18 per 1,000 heads. So that is, I'm not very good at maths, but that's about, that's a third.
70% reduction, roughly.
70% reduction, yeah. You have to help me out there, Max. But yeah, I mean, she wasn't just doing this for the army. She's doing this for the people as well. And, you know, unfortunately, India still has a lot of problems with sanitation. They still have a lot of problems with sewage there. But you can just imagine what it must have been like. Because we know what it's like now. You imagine what it must have been like when she was over there 150 years ago. I mean, it must have been absolutely dreadful. And she made some huge changes, and not just for the army, but also for the Indians themselves.
The widespread also of her influence shows that she was a worldwide phenomenon, and not just somebody who was famous in this country.
Yeah, unlike this Mary Seacole character. I wonder if they've ever heard of her in India. The Royal Sanitary Commission of 1868 to 1869 presented her with an opportunity to press for compulsory sanitation in private houses. She lobbied the minister responsible, James Stansfield, to strengthen the proposed public health bill into requiring the owners of existing properties to pay for the connection to mains drainage. This strengthened legislation was finally enacted in the Public Health Acts of 1874 and 1875, and at the same time, powers were devolved for enforcing the law down to the local authorities, eliminating central control by medical technocrats. Historians now believe that both drainage and devolved enforcement played a crucial role in increasing the average national life expectancy by 20 years between 1871 and the mid-1930s, during which time medical science made no impact at all on the most fatal of the epidemic diseases. So she increased the national life expectancy by 20 years by doing this. And I guess we must have just been using the equivalent of bedpans up until this point.
When people I think even in private residences, a lot of houses that were built in order to house the rural poor who were coming into the cities at that time, because this was the part of the Industrial Revolution where people were leaving the land and coming into the cities. They needed cheap housing, and this is when back-to-back houses were constructed, which were, you know, even more cramped and crowded than the two up and two down terrace houses that have survived to modern day times. But with these back-to-back houses, they tended to be built in squares with an internal courtyard where people would hang their washing out and things of that sort, and where there would be a kind of a wash house that people could go there to scrub their clothes clean. But they also used to have communal toilets in these back-to-back courtyards, and the communal toilets in the early days would have not been connected to mains drainage. They would have been what used to be called earth closets, as opposed to a water closet. So an earth closet was just basically a big box that had a lid on the top with a hole cut in it, and the earth was and so you would go and you would relieve yourself through the hole, and then you would just have it'd be a bucket full of loose earth by the side, and you would put a couple of shovelfuls of loose earth to cover over what you'd just produced, so that it wouldn't stink too much. And that's how toilets were in the 1800s. And so you know, we can see that the lack of sanitation, you know, or connection to drainage and to the sewers, etc., how that must have had a massive impact on people. You know, if you regularly, several times a day, if depending on how regular you are, if you had to go and sit in a nurse closet where you were sitting in the same sort of crude conditions that existed in the front line during the First World War, you know, where soldiers used to go and sit on a plank, and there were a notable number of deaths where soldiers slipped off the plank and fell into the excrement-filled pit behind them. And, you know, so that sort of sanitation was what passed for the norm in those days.
Well, that's one step up from, I was thinking of the bedpan, and they were just throwing the bedpan out the window into the street. I guess that must have been in the Middle Ages. But I do find it amazing to think that, what was it, 3000 BC in India, we actually had sanitation systems. White people built them. Not Mohenjo-Daro, trying to think of the exact name of this part of India. It was before the Aryan invasion. And we've got the remains of the city that was built there, and it has the facility for the sanitation and the sewage to pass out to these to this stream that would then take the waste away. And we had the same thing in Roman times, and it's always something that's been associated with white people is sanitation. So I do find it incredible that we made it all the way up to 1850 before we actually sorted out sanitation in London and in our cities. I do find that incredible when we had all of this in antiquity. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Well, if you go to visit Cambridge, there, I can't remember the name of the street now, but there is a large street which runs along the front of the Fitzwilliam Museum. And on either side of that street, there are the open sewers that used to exist in times of old that would have been flowing with effluent, I would imagine that most large cities would have had streets that had those kind of open sewers to begin with.
Right, and that part of India was the Lower Indus civilization, is what it's actually called, with this early evidence of sanitation. Well, unfortunately, from 1857 onwards, Nightingale was intermittently bedridden and suffering from depression. A recent biography cites brucellosis, a parasitic joint and muscle pain, which is what that is. It actually comes from unpasteurized cow's milk, apparently, as a parasite that's actually within the milk. So it wasn't anything to do with her not being clean herself. It was just caught from these animals, this brucellosis. She also had associated spondylitis, which is an inflammation of the vertebrae. And they suggest that this was the cause of her being bedridden and her depression. Most authorities today accept that she suffered from a particularly extreme form of this brucellosis, the effects of which only began to lift in the early 1880s. Despite her symptoms, she remained phenomenally productive in social reform. During her bedridden years, she also did pioneering work in the field of hospital planning, and her work propagated quickly across Britain and the world, but her output slowed down considerably in the last decade. Imagine that. She's bedridden, and yet she's still working on this. She's still looking at the statistics. She's still designing hospitals. She's still writing. Absolutely incredible. She wrote very little during that final period due to blindness and declining mental abilities, although she still retained an interest in current affairs and was the recipient of more than one award. In 1883, she became the first recipient of the Royal Red Cross. In 1904, she was appointed a Lady of Grace of the Order of St. John. And in 1907, she became the first woman to be awarded the Order of Merit. And in the following year, she was given the Honorary Freedom of the City of London. And she must have been pretty much blind by the time that she was actually getting these awards and being given the Freedom of the City of London. She died peacefully in her sleep in her room at number 10 South Street, Mayfair, London, on the 13th of August 1910 at the age of 90. The offer of a burial in Westminster Abbey was declined by her relatives, and she was instead buried in the churchyard of St. Margaret's Church in East Wellow, Hampshire, near Embley Park, with a simple memorial containing just her initials and dates of birth and death. And I've missed out a little bit here as well. She's actually got some critics of feminism. But do you want to make a comment on her illness and her death here, Max?
Well, it just goes to show how determined she was, that she was prepared to work on, even though she was ill and in a condition where most people would have decided to just sit out their final years. And she was well above the current retirement age, so worked into her 90s, which is a fantastic example, really, of personal productivity and the achievement drive, I suppose that's what you could call it. And so, and she obviously is somebody who is to be emulated and greatly admired.
An incredible dedication to her work there, and sort of knew that was what she was supposed to be doing. Well, she did make some criticism of feminism. Although much of Nightingale's work improved the lot of women everywhere, Nightingale was of the opinion that women craved sympathy and were not as capable as men. She criticised early women's rights activists for decrying an alleged lack of careers for women, at the same time that lucrative medical positions, under the supervision of Nightingale and others, went perpetually unfilled. She preferred the friendship of powerful men, insisting that they had done far more than any women to help her attain her goals. Writing, "I have never found one woman who has altered her life by one iota for me or my opinions." She also referred to herself in the masculine, as, for example, a man of action and a man of business. And that's the example that these feminists should really follow, you know, changing it to a fire person, a police person. It's a fireman, it's a policeman. Man includes both male and female. It goes back to Genesis, where it says that man was created, both male and female created he them. So the word man does actually include both. And I find it interesting here that she says that women craved sympathy and they're not as capable as men, and they don't have the physical strength that men have. I think she would be amazed to see the way that things are today with these feminists. And it is the same today as well. She says here that she decries the fact that women aren't actually taking up these lucrative medical positions. And today we have feminists that are saying, well, we've got to have more women engineers, we've got to have more women's physics teachers, we've got to have more women scientists. But women don't want to study that. And they can never get enough of them in there. And when they do get them in there, they end up having to lower the standards for them. So these women complain that we should be having women in all these men's positions, and that we should be inclusive and pretending that women do these jobs. But the fact of the matter is, they don't really want to do that. Most women want to fulfill their biological urge and have children. Unfortunately, a lot of them today think that they shouldn't have to get married as well. But, you know, that is basically what happens. And this idea that we should be including women in everything that men do is ridiculous. And she wasn't like that. She made great achievements for a woman, but she certainly wasn't somebody that was saying women are exactly the same as men. She knew that she was the exception to the rule. Do you want to comment on that at all, Max?
Well, just really, this is another aspect of what I described earlier on as her being sort of Thatcher-esque in terms of character. Margaret Thatcher always found that it was easier to get along with men than it was to get along with women. And I think that's because Margaret Thatcher had a certain masculinity to her character in certain respects, which made her feel a greater affinity with men, despite the fact that she recognised that she was a woman and that she lived her life as a woman and you know, had children, etc. She was driven by a sort of masculine, what are normally regarded as masculine ambitions. And I think Florence Nightingale was very similar. What I would say is that in a healthy society, there should be room for women who are more masculine in their temperament like that, and who want to go into careers. But, you know, we do have to recognise the fact that that's only going to be a minority of women that are going to be that driven and that forceful. And that, as you say, the majority of women are in competition with men, less persistent and less ambitious. And so this is why we find that in certain spheres and in certain occupations, men predominate and women are a rarity. And that's not because men I don't believe it's because men discriminate against women, because my experience of management is that men are only too pleased to have women amongst them. It sort of brightens up the day, brightens up the working environment, and so it is largely the result of the fact that lots of women don't, you know, aren't that competitive and ambitious, and it's the ambitious nature and the desire to be competitive, or the ability to and the willingness to be competitive, that drives men so that they do achieve a disproportionate number of high positions in society.
Well, men are always driving to be the first at something, or to do something new, and these are masculine attributes. She understood that what she was showing was masculine attributes. She wasn't saying, well, all women are like this, and this is a womanly thing, is to be like this. She understood it was masculine. It was a masculine attribute. And I think you're correct there to say that Margaret Thatcher was the same. I wouldn't class Margaret Thatcher as a feminist. Well, in 1912, the International Committee of the Red Cross instituted the Florence Nightingale Medal, which is awarded every 2 years to nurses or nursing aides for outstanding service. It is the highest international distinction that a nurse can achieve, and is awarded to nurses or nursing aides for exceptional courage and devotion to the wounded, sick or disabled, or to civilian victims of a conflict or disaster, or exemplary services, or a creative and pioneering spirit in the areas of public health or nursing education. Four hospitals in Istanbul are named after her, and there are numerous museums and monuments to her, along with plays, TV series and movies. And there's a long list of attributes to her on the Wikipedia page. And these hospitals in Istanbul, of course, because that's where her hospital was set up. It was actually in what is now Turkey, when it was part of the Crimean War. So certainly somebody worthy of being included in our list of greatest of Britons here. I really wasn't aware of all these things that she did until researching this. And she is a great example of mercy, charity, dedication, pushing yourself to the absolute limits and dedicating your life to improving the lot of your nation, and not just your nation, but all the other peoples of the world. Once again, we see somebody who was a part of the British Empire that did everything that they possibly could for the people, for the natives, once again, for the Indians. She didn't just do this for the British Army. She also massively improved the lot of the Indian population. So another great example of what it means to be British. If you enjoyed that and want to hear more about our greatest Britons, then do check out the Greatest Britons archive. We also feature Greatest Britons in the second half of our Monday podcast, Real Britannia. In the first half, we talk about the news that's important to Britain. And in the second half, we do a presentation on who we believe to be our greatest Britons. Or you can wait until later in the year when I edit the segments together to make it into one podcast like the one that you have just heard. Thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to seeing you again in the future.